Chapter 6. Six funerals. Webb attended six funerals over 3 days. By the fourth one, he couldn't muster a single tear. He walked into the church or the funeral home and listened to people he mostly didn't know talk about fallen men he knew better than he understood himself in some ways. It was as though all of his nerves had been boiled away, along with part of his soul. In a way, he felt incapable of reacting as he was supposed to. He was terrified he would start laughing when he should be mourning. At the services, half the caskets were open, the rest not. Some of the dead men had fared better with the size and placement of the wounds that had killed them, and thus had open caskets. However, staring at pale, collapsed faces and rigid, shrunken bodies in metal boxes, inhaling flower fragrance and hearing the sobs of all those around him made Webb wish he could just lie down in a box too and be put away in the ground to hide forever. The funeral of a hero. There were far worse ways to be remembered. He had wrapped his hand back up in the layers of gauze because he felt guilty walking among the bereaved without a trace of a wound. It was a pathetic thing to be concerned with, he knew, yet he felt like a walking slap in the face to the survivors. All they really knew was that Webb London had somehow gotten off with barely a scratch. Had he run? Had he left his comrades to die? He could see those questions in some of the people's faces. Was that always the fate of the sole survivor? The funeral processions had passed between endless lines of men and women in uniform and hundreds of others dressed in the neat suits and sensible shoes of the FBI. Motorcycles led the way, citizens lined the streets, and flags everywhere flew at half-mast. The president and most of his cabinet came, along with many other VIPs. For a few days, the entire world talked of nothing else except the slaughter of six good men in an alley. Not much was said about the seventh man, and for that, Webb was mostly grateful. Still, he wondered how long that moratorium could possibly last for him. The city of Washington was deeply stricken, and it was not entirely over the fate of the slain men, for the broader implications were troubling. Had criminals really become so brazen? Was society coming apart at the seams? Were the police not keeping pace? Was American law enforcement's crown jewel, the FBI, losing its luster? The Middle Eastern and Chinese news services were having a particularly delicious time reporting yet another example of Western mayhem that would one day bring arrogant America to its soft knees. Cheers were no doubt racing up and down the streets of Baghdad, Tehran, Pyongyang, and Beijing at the thought of the old USA falling apart one miserable media-fueled crisis at a time. The pundits on American soil were spouting so many absurd scenarios that Webb no longer even opened a newspaper or turned on a TV or radio. If anyone had asked him, though, he would have said that the whole world, and not just the United States, had been screwed up for a long time. There had been some relief from this crossfire, though its catalyst was another appalling tragedy. A Japanese commercial jetliner had crashed off the Pacific coast, so the newsmongers had chased after that story and left the alley and its dead behind for now. A single news truck was still there, but scraps of 300 bodies floating in the ocean was a far bigger draw than a days-old story about a team of dead FBI agents. And for that, Webb was also grateful. Leave us alone to grieve in peace. He had been debriefed uptown at the Hoover Building and at the WFO on 3 different occasions by several teams of investigators. They had their pads and pencils, their recorders, and some of the younger agents even had laptops. They had asked Webb many more questions than he had answers for. However, when he told each group that he didn't know why he had frozen and then fallen, the pencils had stopped scribbling on paper, fingers had stopped clacking on keyboards. When you say you froze, did you see something, hear something to make you do that? The man spoke in a monotone, which to Webb was one imperceptible inflection short of incredulity, or worse, outright disbelief. I don't really know. You really don't know? You're not sure if you froze? I'm not sure. I mean, I did. I couldn't move. It was like I was paralyzed. But you moved after your team was killed. Yes, Webb conceded. What had changed to allow you to do that? I don't know. And when you got to the courtyard, you fell. That's right. Right before the guns opened fire, said another investigator. Webb could barely hear his own answer. Yes. The silence that followed these meager responses came close to dissolving Webb's already bludgeoned insides. During each debriefing, Webb had kept his hands on top of the table, his gaze steady on each questioner's face, his posture in a slight forward lean. These men were all professional, seasoned inquisitors. Webb knew that if he looked away, sat back, rubbed his head the wrong way, or worse yet, crossed his arms, they would instantly conclude he was a lying sack of shit. Webb wasn't being untruthful, but he wasn't telling all of the truth either. Yet if Webb started talking about how the vision of a little boy had had a weird effect on him, perhaps inexplicably caused him to freeze, thus saving his life, or about then feeling weighed down as though encased in concrete, and then seconds later being able to freely move, he would be finished at the Bureau. The higher-ups tended to frown on field agents making insane comments. Yet he had one thing going for him. Those machine gun nests didn't disintegrate by themselves, and his rifle rounds were embedded in all of them. And the snipers had seen everything, and he had warned hotel team and saved the boy on top of it. Webb made sure he said that. He made sure all of them knew that. You can kick me while I'm down, friends, just not too hard. I'm a damn hero after all. I'll be all right, Webb had told them. I just need a little time. I'll be all right. And for one awful moment, Webb thought that might be the first actual lie he had told all day. They would call him back in as needed, they told him. For now, they just wanted him to do nothing. He was to take plenty of time to get himself together. The Bureau had offered the assistance of a counselor, a mental health professional. In fact, they had insisted on it, and Webb said he would go, although there was still a stigma at the Bureau for those seeking such help. When things looked okay, Webb was told, he would be assigned to another assaulter or sniper team, if he so desired, until Charlie could be rebuilt. If not, he could take another position within the Bureau. There was even talk of allowing him to burn an Office of Preference transfer that would allow him to proceed directly to GO in the form of an office he would retire from. That sort of treatment was usually reserved for senior-level agents and symbolized that the Bureau was really unsure of what to do with him. Officially, Webb was in the middle of an administrative inquiry that might well blossom into a full investigation, depending on how things shook out. Well, no one had given Webb his Miranda rights, which was both good and bad. Good because Webb getting his Miranda warning would mean he was under arrest. Bad in that anything he said during the inquiry could be used against him in civil or criminal proceedings. The only thing he had done wrong, apparently, was having survived. And yet that was a source of guilt far stronger than anything the Bureau could charge him with. No, really, whatever he wanted, Webb was told, he could have. They were all his friends. He had their full support. Webb asked how the investigation was going and didn't get an answer in return. So much for their full support, Webb thought. Get better, another man had told him. That's all you need to focus on. As he was leaving from his last debriefing, he got one final question. "How's the hand?" the man asked. Webb didn't know the guy, and although the question seemed innocent enough, there was something in the fellow's eyes that made Webb want to deck him. Instead, Webb said it was just fine, thanked the mall, and left. On the way out from the last session, he had passed the FBI's Wall of Honor, where hung plaques for each of the FBI personnel killed in the line of duty. There would be a major addition coming to the wall, the largest single one in the history of the Bureau, in fact. Webb had sometimes wondered if he would ever end up on there, with his professional life compacted into a chunk of wood and brass hanging on a wall. He left Hoover and drove home, besieged by many more questions than he wanted to confront. FBI also officially stood for fidelity, bravery, and integrity. And right now, Webb didn't feel he possessed any of these qualities. Chapter 7. Francis Westbrook was a giant of a man, with the height and girth of an NFL starting left tackle. Regardless of the weather or season, his clothes of choice were silk tropical short-sleeved shirts, matching slacks and suede loafers with no socks. His head was bald, his large ears were covered with diamond studs, and his enormous fingers were festooned with gold rings. He wasn't a dandy of any sort, but there simply weren't that many things he could spend his drug earnings on without the law, or even worse, the IRS sniffing around. And he also liked to look good. Right now, Westbrook was riding in the back seat of a large Mercedes sedan with black-tinted windows. To the left of him was his first lieutenant, Antoine Peebles. Driving was a tall, well-built young man named Tuna, and in the passenger seat was his chief of security, Clyde Macy, the only white guy in Westbrook's entire crew, and it was easy to see that the man carried that distinction with great pride. Peebles had a neatly trimmed beard and afro, was short and heavyset, but he wore his Armani and his designer shades well. He looked more like a Hollywood exec than a high-level drug entrepreneur. Macy looked like a breathing skeleton, preferred his clothes black and professional-looking, and with his shaved head, could easily have been mistaken for a neo-Nazi. This represented the inner circle of Westbrook's small empire, and the leader of that empire held a 9mm pistol in his right hand and seemed to be looking for someone to use it on. "You want to tell me one more time how you lost Kevin?" He looked at Peebles and clutched the pistol even tighter. Its safety was in the grip, and Westbrook had just released it. Peebles seemed to recognize this and yet didn't hesitate in responding. "If you let us keep somebody on him 24/7, then we'd never lose him. He goes out sometimes at night. He went out that night and didn't come back." Westbrook slapped his enormous thigh. "He was in that alley. The feds had him and now they don't. He's mixed up with this shit somehow and it happened in my damn backyard." He smacked the gun against the door and roared, "I want Kevin back!" Peebles looked at him nervously, while Macy showed no reaction. Westbrook put a hand on the driver's shoulder. "Duna, you get some of the boys together and you're gonna hit every part of this damn town, you hear me? I know you already done it once, but you do it again. I want that boy back nice and safe, you hear me? Nice and safe, and don't come back till you done it. Damn it, you hear me, Tuna?" Tuna glanced in the rearview mirror.
I hear you.
"Set up," said Peebles. "All around, to put the blame on you."
"You think I ain't know that? You think 'cause you went to college that you smart and I'm stupid? I know the feds coming after my ass on this. I know the word on the street. Somebody's trying to get all the crews together, almost like a damn union. But they know I ain't joining shit, and it's messing up their plan." Westbrook's eyes were red. He hadn't slept much in the last 48 hours.
That was just his life. Surviving the night was usually the big project of the day. And all he could think about was a little boy out there somewhere. He was getting close to the edge. He could feel it. He had known this day might come, and still he was not prepared for it.
Whoever got Kevin, they gonna let me know it. They want something. They want me to jump my crew in, that's what they want.
And you'll give it to them?
Anything I got, they can have, so long as I get Kevin back.
He paused and looked out the window, at the corners and alleys and cheap bars they were passing, where his drug tentacles slithered. He did a brisk business in the suburbs, too, where the real money was.
Yeah, that's right. I get Kevin back, and then I kill every one of the mothers. I do it myself.
He pointed the pistol at an imaginary foe.
Start with the knees and work my way up.
Peebles looked warily at Macy, who still showed no sign of any reaction. It was as though he were made of stone.
Well, nobody's contacted us so far, said Peebles.
They will. They didn't take Kevin because they want to shoot hoops with him. They want me. Well, I'm right here. They just got to come to the party. I'm ready to party. Bring it the fuck on.
Westbrook spoke more calmly.
Word is one of them dudes didn't eat it in that courtyard. That right?
Peebles nodded.
Webb London.
They say machine guns, 50 caliber shit. How's a dude slip that?
Peebles shrugged his shoulders, and Westbrook looked at Macy.
What you hear on that, Mace?
Nobody's saying for sure right now, but what I hear is the man didn't go in that courtyard. He got scared, freaked or something.
Freaked or something, said Westbrook. Okay, you get some shit on this man and you let me see it. Man walk away from something like that, man got something to tell me. Like maybe where Kevin is.
He looked at his men.
Whoever shot them feds up got Kevin. You can count on that.
Well, like I said, we could have had him on round the clock, commented Peebles.
What the hell kind of life is that? Said Westbrook. He ain't got to live that way, not because of me. But the feds come after my ass, then I'll just point them boys in another direction. But we got to know which way that is. With six damn feds dead, they ain't gonna be looking to cut no deals. They want some serious ass to fry, and it ain't gonna be mine.
Whoever took Kevin, there's no guarantee they'll let him go, said Peebles. I know you don't want to hear this, but we have no way of knowing if Kevin's even alive.
Westbrook lay back against the seat.
Oh, he's alive, all right. Ain't nothing wrong with Kevin. Not right now, anyway.
How can you be sure?
I just know, and that's all you need to know. You just get me something on this Fed mother.
Webb London.
Webb London. And if he ain't got what I need, then he'll wish he died with his crew. Hit it, Tuna. We got business.
The car sped on into the night. Chapter 8. It took Webb a couple of days to make an appointment with a psychiatrist whom the Bureau used on an independent contractor basis. The FBI had trained people on staff, but Webb had opted for someone on the outside. He wasn't sure why, yet spilling his guts to anyone on the inside right now didn't seem like a good idea. Rightly or not, tell the feds shrink, you're telling the feds, was Webb's thinking. To hell with patient confidentiality. The Bureau was still pretty much in the dark ages when it came to the mental health of their people, and that probably was as much the fault of the individual agents as the organization. Until several years ago, if you worked at the FBI and were feeling stressed or were having problems with alcohol or substance abuse, you pretty much kept it to yourself and dealt with it in your own way. The old-school agents would have given no more thought to seeking counseling than they would about leaving home without their gun. If an agent was seeking professional help, no one knew about it, and certainly no one talked about it.
You were, in a sense, tainted goods if you did. And the indoctrination process of being a member of the Bureau seemed to instill both a stoicism and stubborn independence that were difficult to overcome. Then the powers that be had finally decided that the stress of working for the FBI, reflected in rising rates of alcohol and drug abuse and the high incidence of divorce, needed to be addressed. An Employee Assistance Program, or EAP, was instituted. Each FBI division was assigned an EAP coordinator and counselor. If the in-house counselor couldn't handle the situation, he or she would refer the patient to an approved outside source, as Webb had opted to have done. The EAP wasn't widely known at the Bureau, and Webb had never gotten any written materials on its existence. It was just sort of whispered ear to ear. The old stigma, despite the Bureau's efforts, was still there. The psychiatric offices were in a high-rise building in Fairfax County, near Tyson's Corner. Webb had seen Dr. O'Bannon, one of the psychiatrists who worked here before. The first time was years ago, when HRT had been called up to rescue some students at a private school in Richmond, Virginia. A bunch of paramilitary types belonging to a group calling themselves the Free Society, who apparently were seeking to create an Aryan culture by means of their own version of ethnic cleansing, had burst into the school and immediately killed two teachers. The standoff had lasted almost 24 hours. HRT had finally gone in when it appeared imminent that the men were going to start killing again. Things were going perfectly until something had alerted the Freeze right before HRT was ready to pounce. The resulting shootout had left five of the Freeze dead and two HRT personnel injured, Webb critically so. The only other hostage to die was a 10-year-old boy named David Canfield. Webb had been almost close enough to the child to pull him to safety when things went to hell. The dead boy's face had intruded into his dreams so often that Webb had voluntarily sought counseling. At that time, there was no EAP, so after he had recovered from his injuries, Webb had discreetly gotten O'Bannon's name from another agent whom O'Bannon was seeing. It had been one of the hardest things Webb had ever done, because, in effect, he was admitting that he couldn't handle his problems. He never talked about it with other HRT members, and he would have cut out his tongue before he would reveal that he was seeing a shrink. His colleagues would have only seen that as a weakness, and at HRT there was no room for that. The operators at HRT had had a previous encounter with mental health counseling, and it had not gone well. After Waco, the Bureau had brought in some counselors who had met directly with the stricken men as a group instead of individually. The result would have been comical if it hadn't been so pathetically sad. That was the last time the Bureau had tried that sort of thing with HRT. The most recent time Webb had seen O'Bannon was right after Webb's mother had died. After quite a few sessions with O'Bannon, Webb concluded that things were never going to be right on that score, and he had lied and told O'Bannon that he was just fine. He didn't blame O'Bannon, for no doc could make that mess right, he knew. It would have taken a miracle. O'Bannon was short and heavy-set and often wore a black turtleneck that made his multiple chins even more pronounced. Webb remembered that O'Bannon's handshake was limp, his manner pleasant enough, and yet Webb had felt like running for the door the first time the two had met. Instead, he had followed O'Bannon back to his office and plunged into some dangerous waters.
"We'll be able to help you, Webb. It'll just take time. I'm sorry we have to meet under such difficult circumstances, but people don't come to me because things are wonderful. It's my lot in life, I suppose."
Webb said that was good, and yet his spirit sank. O'Bannon clearly had no magic that would make Webb's world normal again. They had sat in O'Bannon's office. There was no couch, but rather a small love seat, not nearly long enough to lie down upon. O'Bannon had explained it as the greatest of all misperceptions in our field. Not every psychiatrist has a couch. O'Bannon's office was sterile, with white walls, industrial furnishings, and very few items of a personal nature. It all made Webb feel about as comfortable as sitting on death row, waiting to do a last dance with Mr. Sparky. They made small talk, presumably to ease Webb into opening up. There was a pad and pen next to O'Bannon, but he never picked them up. "I'll do that later," O'Bannon had said when Webb asked him about his lack of note-taking. "For now, let's just talk." He had a darting gaze that had been unsettling to Webb, though the psychiatrist's voice was soft and relatively soothing. After an hour, the session was up, and Webb could see nothing much that had been accomplished. He knew more about O'Bannon than the man knew about Webb. He had not gotten around to any of the issues disturbing him. "These things take time, Webb," O'Bannon had said as he led Webb out. "It'll come. Don't you worry. It just takes time. Rome wasn't built in a day." Webb wanted to ask him exactly how long it would take to build Rome in this case, but he said nothing except goodbye. At first, Webb had believed that he would never go back to see the short, pudgy man with the blank office, and yet he had. And O'Bannon had worked through the issues with him session after session, getting him to deal with things. But Webb had never forgotten the little boy who had been gunned down in cold blood, with Webb mere feet away and unable to save him. That would have been unhealthy to ever forget something like that. O'Bannon had told Webb that he and others at his psychiatric practice had catered to the needs of bureau personnel for many years and had helped agents and administrative staff through lots of crises. Webb had been surprised at that because he assumed he was one of the few who had ever sought professional counseling. O'Bannon had looked at him in a very knowing way and said, "Just because people don't talk about it doesn't mean they don't want to address their issues or don't want to get better. I can, of course, reveal no names, but trust me, you are definitely not alone in coming to me from the FBI. Agents who hide their heads in the sand are just ticking bombs waiting to explode." Now, Webb wondered if he was a ticking bomb. He went inside and over to the elevators, each step heavier than the previous one. With his mind clearly elsewhere, Webb nearly collided with a woman coming from the other direction. He apologized and pushed the elevator button. The car came, and they both got on. Webb punched the button for his floor and stepped back. As they headed up, Webb glanced over at the woman. She was average height, slender, and very attractive. He put her age at late 30s. She wore a gray pantsuit, the collar of a white blouse topping it. Her hair was a wavy black and cut short, and she had on small clip earrings. She carried a briefcase. Her long fingers curled around the handle, pressing tightly, noted Webb, whose whole professional life was spent obsessing over the small details, because the little things almost always determined his future, or lack of one. The car stopped at Webb's floor, and he was a little surprised when the woman got off too. But then he recalled she had not pushed another floor button. Well, so much for always observing the little details. He followed her to the office he was going to. She glanced back at him. "Can I help you?" Her voice was low, precise, and somehow inviting, comforting to him. The unusually deep blue of her eyes caught Webb's attention. The eyes were also big, sad, and peering. They held you, those eyes did. "I'm here to see Dr. O'Bannon." "Did you have an appointment?" She seemed wary, Webb thought. Yet he also knew women had every right to be suspicious when confronted with strange men. He had seen the ugly results of many such encounters, and those images never left you. "Yes, for 9 o'clock, Wednesday morning. I'm a little early." She gave him a sympathetic look. Actually, today is Tuesday.
Webb muttered, shit, and shook his head wearily. Guess I'm getting my days sort of mixed up. Sorry to bother you.
He turned to leave, and he was reasonably sure he would never come back.
I'm sorry, but you look very familiar to me, the woman said.
Webb turned slowly back.
I apologize, she added. I'm not usually that forward, but I know I've seen you before.
Well, if you work here, you probably did. I've been to see O'Bannon before.
No, it wasn't here. I believe it was on TV.
Realization finally swept across her features.
You're Webb London, the FBI agent, aren't you?
He couldn't decide what to say for a few moments, and she simply looked at him, apparently awaiting confirmation of her observation.
Yes, Webb glanced past her. Do you work here?
I have an office here.
So you're a shrink, too?
She put out her hand.
We prefer psychiatrists. I'm Claire Daniels.
Webb shook her hand, and then they stood there awkwardly.
I'm going to put some coffee on if you'd like a cup, she finally said.
Don't go to any trouble.
She turned and unlocked the door. Webb followed her inside. They sat in the small reception room and drank the coffee. Webb glanced around the empty space.
Office closed today?
No, most people don't get in before 9.
It always surprised me that you don't have a receptionist here.
Well, we want to make it as comfortable for people as possible. And announcing yourself to a stranger because you're here to receive treatment can be very intimidating. We know when we have appointments, and the doorbell lets us know when someone has arrived, and we come right out. We have this common waiting area because that's unavoidable, but as a rule, we don't like to make patients sit out here with one another. That can be awkward, too.
Sort of like people sitting around playing Guess My Psychosis?
She smiled. Something like that. Dr. O'Bannon started this practice many years ago, and he cares quite deeply about the comfort zone of the people who come here for help. The last thing you want to do is to increase the anxiety level of already anxious people.
So you know O'Bannon well?
Yes, I actually used to work for him. Then he simplified his life a while back, and we're all on our own now, but we still share this office space. We've come to prefer it that way. He's very good. He'll be able to help you.
You think so? Webb said, without a trace of hope.
I guess, like the rest of the country, I've been following what happened. I'm very sorry about your colleagues.
Webb drank his coffee in silence. Claire said,
if you were thinking of waiting, Dr. O'Bannon is teaching at George Washington University. He won't be in at all today.
No big deal. My mistake. Thanks for the coffee. He rose.
Mr. London, would you like me to tell him you were here?
It's Webb. And no, I don't think I'll be back on Wednesday.
Claire stood too.
Is there something I can do to help you?
He held up his cup.
You already made the Java.
Webb took a breath. It was time to get out of here.
What are you doing for the next hour? He asked instead, and then was stunned to hear his own words.
Just paperwork, she said quickly, her gaze downcast,
her face slightly red, as though he had just asked her out to the prom, and instead of saying no to his advance, she was deciding, for some unknown reason, to encourage it.
How would you like to talk to me instead?
Professionally? That's not possible. You're Dr. O'Bannon's patient.
How about human to human?
Webb had absolutely no idea where any of these words were coming from. She hesitated for a moment and then told him to wait. She went into an office and then came back out a few minutes later.
I tried reaching Dr. O'Bannon at the university, but they couldn't track him down. Without talking to him, I really can't counsel you. You have to understand it's a touchy thing ethically, Webb. I'm not into poaching patients.
Webb abruptly sat down. Wouldn't it ever be justified? She mulled this over for a few moments.
I suppose if your regular doctor wasn't available and you were in crisis, it would be.
He's not available, and I'm in an honest-to-God crisis. Webb was being absolutely truthful, for it was like he was back in that courtyard, unable to move, unable to do a damn thing to help, useless. If she still refused him, Webb wasn't sure he could even manage to get up and leave. Instead, she led him down the hallway to her office and closed the door behind them. Webb looked around. There could not have been a greater difference between Claire Daniels' digs and those of O'Bannon. The walls were a muted gray instead of stark white, and cozy with femininely floral curtains instead of industrial shades. There were pictures hung everywhere, mostly of people, presumably family. The degrees on the wall evidenced Claire Daniels' impressive academic accomplishments, degrees from Brown and Columbia universities, and her medical sheepskin from Stanford. On one table was a glass container that had a label reading, Therapy in a Jar. There were unlit candles on tables and cactus lamps in two corners. On shelves and on the floor were dozens of stuffed animals. There was a leather chair against one wall. And by God, Claire Daniels had a couch.
You want me to sit there?
He pointed to it, trying desperately to keep his nerves in check. He suddenly wished he wasn't armed, because he was starting to feel a little out of control.
Actually, if you don't mind, I prefer the couch.
He collapsed in the chair and then watched as she switched her flats for slippers that were lying next to the couch. The momentary sight of her bare feet had prompted an unexpected reaction from Webb. There was nothing sexual about it. It made Webb think of the bloodied skin in the courtyard, the remains of Charlie Team. Claire sat down on the couch, pulled a pad and pen off the side table, and uncapped the pen. Webb took a series of small breaths to arrest his nerves.
O'Bannon doesn't take notes during the session, he commented.
I know, she said with a wry smile. I don't think my memory is as good as his. Sorry.
I didn't even ask if you're on the Bureau's approved list of outside contractors. I know O'Bannon is.
I am too. And this session will have to be revealed to your supervisor. Bureau policy.
But not the content of the session.
No, of course not. Just that we met. The same basic rules of confidentiality apply here as they would in a normal psychiatrist and patient relationship.
Basic rules?
There are modifications, Webb, because of the unique job you have.
O'Bannon explained that to me when I was seeing him, but I guess I was never really clear on it.
Well, I'm under an obligation to inform your supervisor if, during a session, anything is revealed that poses a threat to yourself or others.
I guess that's fair.
You think so? Well, from my point of view, it gives me a great deal of discretion, because where one hears something benign, another hears genuine threats. So I'm not so sure that policy is very fair to you. But just so you know, I have never had occasion to use that discretion, and I've been working with people from the FBI, DEA, and other law enforcement agencies for a long time.
What else has to be revealed?
The other major one is drug use or specific therapies.
Right. The Bureau is a stickler for that, I know, said Webb. Even over-the-counter stuff, you have to report that you're taking. It can actually get to be quite a pain in the ass.
He looked around.
Your place is a lot more comfortable. O'Bannon's office reminds me of an operating room.
Everybody approaches their work differently. She stopped and stared at his waist.
Webb glanced down and saw that his windbreaker had fallen open there, and the grip of his pistol was visible. He zipped up the jacket as Claire looked down at her pad.
Sorry, Webb. It's not like it's the first time I've seen an agent with a gun. Though I suppose when you don't see them every day,
They can be scary as hell, he finished her thought. He eyed the array of furry toys. What's with all the stuffed animals?
I have a lot of children as patients, she said, adding, unfortunately. The animals make them feel more at ease. To tell the truth, they make me feel more at ease, too.
It's hard to believe kids would need a psychiatrist.
Most of them have eating disorders, bulimia, anorexia, usually centered on issues of control between them and their parents. So you have to treat the child and the parent. It's not an easy world for children.
It's not all that great for adults, either.
She gave him a look that Webb interpreted as a quick appraisal. You've been through a lot in your life.
More than some, less than others. You're not going to make me take an inkblot test, are you?
He said this as a joke, but he was actually serious. Psychologists perform Rorschach, MMPI, MMCI, and neurotesting. I'm just a humble psychiatrist.
I had to take the MMPI when I joined Hostage Rescue.
The Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. I'm familiar with it.
It's designed to ferret out the crazies.
In a manner of speaking, yes. Did it?
Some of the guys failed it. Me, I figured out what the test was for and just lied my way through it.
Claire Daniels' eyebrows lifted slightly, and her gaze once more went to where his gun was. That's comforting.
I guess I'm not real clear on the difference between psychologists and psychiatrists, that is.
A psychiatrist has to take the MCATs, then do 4 years of medical school. After that, you have to serve 3 years of residency in psychiatry at a hospital. I also did a fourth-year residency in forensic psychiatry. I've been in private practice ever since. As medical doctors, psychiatrists can also prescribe medication, whereas psychologists generally can't.